25% of our annual budget comes from listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting CKUW 95.9 FM at Fun Drive.
Hi, this is Olivia, and you're listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. This week, I was invited to moderate a discussion with Andrew Subisati and Alexandra West of the Faculty of Horror podcast for the Uniter Speaker Series. I want to thank Andrea and Alexandra for speaking with me. I'm such a huge fan of their show, so it was really cool to speak with them. I also want to thank the Uniter for inviting me to host the discussion. If you missed the Q&A, you can watch it on the Uniter's Facebook and Instagram pages. Finally, I'd like to thank everyone for donating to Bikini Drive-In during CKUW's annual fund drive. Thanks so much to John, Kent, Daniel, Mandy, and Mike for donating to the show. If you miss Fun Drive, you can donate to CKUW all year round at fundrive.ckuw.ca. Thanks so much. To this edition of the Uniter Speaker Series with very special guests, Alexandra West and Andrew Subisati of the Faculty of Horror podcast. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge that the University of Winnipeg Students Association and the Uniter live and work on the unceded lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Dakota, Dene, Métis, and Ojibwe Cree Nations, and are sustained by water sourced from Shoal Lake 40 First Nation. My name is Olivia Norquay, and I'll be your moderator tonight. I host the feminist horror film podcast and radio show Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM. Tonight's event is part of the Uniter Speaker Series, an extension of the University of Winnipeg and downtown community newspaper, the Uniter. The Uniter Speaker Series goal is to inform, educate, and enlighten the community through free lectures available to all. And again, today I'm speaking with Alexandra West and Andrew Subisati of the Faculty of Horror podcast. And thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Tackling all things horror with a slash of analysis and research, horror journalists and occasional academics, Andrea Subisati and Alexandra West, are your hosts for brain-pumping discussions on all things that go bump in the night. Produced independently in Toronto, the Faculty of Horror is your best source for classic and contemporary horror film discussions that will haunt the libraries of your mind. If you have any questions, please put it in the Facebook Live chat, and we will try our best to answer them. And if you require any other Facebook Live accommodations, please private message the Uniter on Facebook. All right, shall we get started? Cool. So can you tell us about the Faculty of Horror?
Right off the bat, I was struck by that description that we wrote how many years ago?
8.
Are we still the best source of
brain? I literally just clocked that as well. I was like, the best? We're one of them.
There didn't used to be so many.
Andrew and I created and host this podcast, Faculty of Horror, together, and it's all about mainly horror movies. Occasionally we'll throw in some TV stuff or some other stuff, but we tackle horror films from an academic perspective. We both have our backgrounds. We did a lot of academia and did our undergrads and MAs, and we met well after we'd finished those and became friends, discovered we had this shared passion for horror and that we wrote about horror in our MAs. And we wanted to take what we had learned and what we continued to learn and bring it to people with less barriers and more, you know, kind of just less highfalutin jargon and more plain talk.
Yeah, and we started the podcast in 2012. And so, as I said before, the podcast landscape was nowhere near what it was now. It was the Wild West. If you had a microphone and we recorded on a piece of crap USB Rock Band microphone on my couch in my apartment for many, many years, and just, you know, editing on freeware and uploading to archives. So we did it really punk rock style. I feel like nowadays it's, you know, you can't start a podcast unless it's polished and you have this and you have that and all the stats and what have you. But it wasn't like that when we started, which I think took a lot of the pressure off. We didn't monitor our numbers too carefully. And you know, we were friends. So it was an opportunity to hang out and it was fun more than anything else.
And how did you both get started in horror journalism?
For me, I had moved to Toronto. I'd finished my MA and I had it published as a book. And I know you're going to ask me later about advice in horror journalism and stuff. We'll get to that. Here's a piece of advice. Don't publish with an academic publisher if you want people to read your stuff. My master's thesis was published as a book, and, you know, I was hoping, you know, horror and academia and zombies were really, really hot at the time. So I was kind of hoping that perhaps a course might pick up my book as a textbook, as a reading or something, and then it might generate some sales. But what I got was a skinny little book that was like $60 that you had to order from overseas. And so that was kind of a little, but I had a book launch party here in Toronto and I got Rumorg to sponsor it, which is how I met them and got to know them, started volunteering at events around the office and just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. And I finished my MA and my undergrad and my MA was in theater. And pretty much as soon as I finished my MA, I was like, I don't know if I like theater that much, but I always loved horror and I loved movies. And I was able to write some of my like final papers about film and especially horror films. And I had become acquainted through that research with some horror blogs and websites. And I was like, I kind of want to try that. So I started a blog, I pitched around, got to know some people at various websites and started writing for them. And I made an itty bitty tiny name for myself, like itty itty bitty. And then Andrew and I started Faculty of Horror. And as we kept going with it, I got to know some more people. And then I started getting asked to contribute and write, which is really nice. I actually started getting paid for it, which was very exciting. And now I do probably less freelance overall. I just have a bit less time for it, unfortunately. But I still contribute chapters to books. Andrew and I have contributed some recently, and over the last few years, I've written two books, one on New French Extremity, one on the 90s teen horror cycle. So those are huge passion projects of mine, and kind of help solidify where I am in the community, I guess. So yeah.
Cool. What are some of your favorite moments from the show? If you have it.
Can I say all of them?
Yeah.
No.
This is a tricky question. I it's anytime I feel like Andrea will drop something on me, in terms of like a knowledge bomb, and I'll just sit there in the recording and go like, and that happened like at the beginning and it still happens now. Like, you want to talk about how to keep a relationship alive, like drop knowledge bombs on each other. So that always keeps me really engaged and really refreshed. And then just for something that made me like, I don't know, Andrea, if you remember this, because we drink while we podcast. I don't tend to drink a lot, but while we podcast, it's a bit of our ritual and tradition. And we had a listener send us alcohol this summer. She sent us these little like little packs. Would you call them, Andrea?
Yeah.
You have to stick a straw on them, and they were like slushies, and they were really, really boozy. And by the end, this was when we were doing our episode on Mimic and the Girl with All the Gifts from our Summer of Plague series. And I just remember getting to the end of Mimic and I was bombed out of my mind to the fact where I couldn't even say Mira Sorvino's name without like descending into like, I was crying, and Andrea, I don't know what happened, but that was really great. Yeah. In the middle of like a pandemic and a plague, and I was just like in this like tiny airless room with like one of my favorite people in the whole world, like crying laughing because of Mira Sorvino.
I can think of a lot of good times along those lines. I can think of a lot of episode recordings where going in, I was like, man, I don't really like this movie. I don't have a lot to say. I don't know about this episode. Like, I don't know about this. And then coming out with new appreciation of it after having a great discussion with Alex, after having a good time, after having some drinks and some laughs. I definitely think of, do you remember the first time we got kind of like recognized out in the world?
Oh, I know, but I have a good story about getting recognized out in the world after you're done. But
okay, okay. We were going to a screening, and this was early, early on. We were going to a little tiny, I think it was Carrie. I think we were going
Oh, yeah. I remember going to
a little rep cinema, and we were on the guest list. And so when we got to the front, I reached over and I said, Andrea Subisati and Alexandra West. And someone behind us in line was like, oh, the Faculty of Horror. And we were like, what? That was a moment. And, you know, we've started doing live shows. We've started going to Salem every year. Those have been really surreal. Meeting fans from all around the world who come to see us was huge.
Yeah. I mean, Salem is like, Salem Horror Fest is such a special event for us. And the fact that we haven't been able to go there in the last almost a year or so has been really heartbreaking. And because just meeting people, you know, it's really special when you do something that's on air and you actually get to meet people. But I'll tell everyone out there a very humbling story perhaps about meeting someone who recognizes you. So right as Toronto is kind of like descending into the lockdown, we were like kind of cruise control. Everyone was like, is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? I went out and I bought a lot of groceries, like a lot of groceries. I was one of those people. Yes, I know. And I was like, well, maybe the pandemic. So I bought my groceries. I might as well go to a public space and see a movie. So I went to the TIFF Bell Lightbox. I went to see a movie and I was paying for my tickets. And the cashier was like, are you Alex from the Faculty of Horror? And I was like, yeah, I am. And she was like, oh my God, I love your show. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Thank you so much. As I swiping my card, it's declined. Not because I didn't have money in it, but because I had exceeded my like daily spend, which is limited on groceries. And she was like, your card's declined. So I had to be like, oh, I have a Visa. You can use that.
I want to maybe add that, like, I mean, getting recognized, it doesn't make us feel like rock stars. It doesn't make us feel like big shots. I think it's just because by the nature of podcasting, we are sitting in a room, just the two of us having a conversation, and then the file goes out and it goes away and we see, you know, we see a couple of tweets, we receive mail and appreciation, but I think it doesn't feel real world until it's out in the real world like that.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Totally. It kind of feels like you're speaking to nobody and everybody simultaneously.
Exactly. Yeah.
What have been the biggest challenges you faced with this project?
I'm going to say technological. you know, I'm a little bit, I'm reasonably computer literate, but, you know, we agreed to do this and yeah, we can do it. And I'll figure it out as we go. And figuring it out as you go is a great way to do anything, because it's really easy to not do something because you don't know how. It's much better to figure it out as you go. But that's not to say that we didn't hit every bump imaginable, from, you know, sound files failing. I still have technological difficulties in recording the podcast to this day. It's our last month's episode. We recorded what, three times?
Three times.
Oh my gosh.
Like the biggest technological failure of our almost 10-year podcast was, you know, at the 9.5-year mark. What the hell? So yeah, I think nowadays there are so many platforms where you just sign up, upload a file, and, you know, the platform does all that for you. We were early enough that we had to figure it out for ourselves. So I think that was a big learning curve and definitely the hardest part for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree. The technology stuff has caused us over the years a fair amount of anxiety. I think also for me, it's like I'm a different person than I was 8 years ago. I've learned stuff. I like to think I've evolved a bit. I have different perspectives on things. And so it's really strange when there's like this past version of yourself that's out there and it just exists. And someone could look me up and pick an episode where I make a joke I would never make today, or I say something that I know I shouldn't use, like, I now know that's not the proper term. I would say something else now. So that you know, that's strange, but I think we've always tried to address those things. And so we kind of just try to keep up with it. Like, hey, we said this, this was wrong for that reason. Let's all keep moving forward, hopefully. So that kind of weird past self existing out there is a little weird. She's not my favorite version, but she exists. She's out there.
And have you had...
Totally. We get pretty personal sometimes. Do you remember that time someone told you that they worked at a bookstore and that sometimes they put the show on in the store?
Yes.
In the speakers? That scared the shit out of me. That fucked me up, to be honest.
Yeah. I guess that also kind of goes hand in hand with meeting people, because we are so personal, so that it's like, and I'm quite private in a lot of ways. So most people don't know a lot of this stuff about me, yet there's, you know, thousands of people out there who know certain things about me that some of the people I speak to 40 hours a week have no idea about.
Do either of you have a favorite movie you've covered for the show?
I think probably my favorite overall episode we've ever done was on Get Out and Stepford Wives. In part of how those two films speak together, also because I deeply love both of those films. And I was a little nervous about that episode because it felt like two such huge movies that we were gonna like do, and were we gonna do it justice? And I don't think it's like the best episode or the like best thing ever. But I think for us, we did a really good job, and I'm really proud of that episode because I think we busted our asses for it. And I think you can hear it.
I think my favorites are the ones where we tackle Canadian indie films that are near and dear to our hearts that our listeners maybe haven't heard of. And, you know, some of the most rewarding mail and feedback we get from listeners is, I never would have discovered this film if not for you. And I love, love, love it. Pontypool, Piwacket, Cube, like these are kind of examples, and I'm really proud to have the opportunity to do that.
Why do you think people like horror films?
That's kind of the kind of question that, like, I think the answer is going to be different for everyone, and I think that's entirely why we have some people who love our show and some people who really don't. Some people don't like engaging with material that they enjoy on a level that we do. Some people think that picking something apart and, you know, discussing what's problematic about it, what's good, what's bad, where it's strong, where it's weak, is ruining the content, is ruining your enjoyment of it, whereas other people get off on that. So, that's why I like horror. I enjoy how it's a reflection of society, and it forces you to ask yourself these questions, and I enjoy that discussion.
Yeah, I think horror is a really subversive genre, just by its nature, and it deals with, as Andrea was saying, it deals with all the shit that we don't, as a society, like to have out in front of us, all the stuff we try to kind of put away, and we hide, and we sanitize, and it just brings it all to the forefront, so we are forced to deal with it, we are forced to reckon with it, and I think there's so much creativity within the horror genre, and there's so many different approaches to it, so I think it's, you know, there's a bit of that wanting to confront things that we all know are part of life. Death is, you know, one of the great, you know, fates for us all, like the great equalizer. So I think there is a fascination and a curiosity with horror, and people like to touch it and get close to it because it feels more real than so much other content, which, like I was saying, just tries to sanitize everything and kind of placate and keep everyone like, it's all fine, everything's fine, it's all good. And horror is the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Since both of you have seen so many different horror movies, what kinds of films do you find the most terrifying or upsetting or scary or devastating?
I think for me, it's spooky ladies, spooky ghost ladies tend to freak me out. I love slow burns. Slow burns really scare me. But then there's the stuff you don't expect, the stuff that kind of comes out of left field and that frightens you and shakes you to your core that you could have never anticipated. So that's why it always kind of feels like a little bit of a dare, a little bit of a bet to yourself. Of every single horror movie I watch for the first time, I'm like, is this going to be scary or am I going to just enjoy it? I don't know. But spooky ladies tend to get me the most. And I think that pretty much stems from my immortal fear of Zelda from Pet Sematary in 1989.
I still like to torment her with that. If ever I can find a meme, I'll just put it on my Instagram stories and not tag her or anything. And I know like about an hour later, she'll be like, Zelda, I almost dropped my phone. Or I did drop my phone. That's my favorite. That's my favorite or not. I think having a background in sociology, like there are so many conceptual frameworks where you kind of look at the world as made up of these institutions. You can kind of see the bricks. You can kind of see the skeleton of society. And so for me, the horror movies that disrupt that structure are the ones that really kind of shake my tree. And that, like, usually it's people or institutions pushed to unnatural limits that really mess me up, because, you know, these are things that we take for granted. And when those structures are disrupted, as we're seeing, as we're living through right now, it's impossible to predict what'll happen. And sadly, it's impossible to assume that humanity is going to do the right thing, that everybody's going to be on the same page, that we're all going to come together and, you know, fight the monster and fight the foe. It doesn't work that way. And I think that's chilling. And when horror movies remind me of that, that shakes me up.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions for films that kind of fall under that category?
Martyrs? Humans' capacity for cruelty. I think there's a lot of zombie movies where there's always the one shithead who hides their bite from everyone else because they think that they're going to be the exception to the zombie rule. There's always going to be people hoarding supplies, just like there are people hoarding toilet paper. There's always going to be the anti-maskers and stuff. I think, zombie movies for the most part, that's where it's at.
What is your earliest memory of horror films? Alex, you already mentioned Zelda, so maybe that's yours,
I've asked my parents about this, and we can't discern when I started being into horror. It just seemed like something that was very quickly in my life and what I was interested in. I have a really strong memory, and some people ask, like, oh, it's the first horror film you saw in theaters. And for me, that was, I would call it a horror movie in this context, which is Army of Darkness, which preceded my viewing of Pet Sematary by a few years. That was at a sleepover when I was 11. And Army of Darkness, that came out 93, 94, so I would have been 8 or 9. And I remember going to see it with my dad and older brother. And I just assumed my older brother, like, wanted to go home. I guess my dad went with him, and like they took me along because we lived in Montreal and at the time, and their rating system is like, je ne give a fuck. And anyway, I was talking to my brother about it like a few years ago, and I was like, yeah, I remember when you guys took me to Army of Darkness? And he was like, excuse me, took you? You begged us to take you for like weeks. And he wouldn't let up about it. So finally, we had to take you to go see Army of Darkness, like opening night. And I was like, oh, wow. So that is my half first memory of horror, but I guess I always liked the freaky stuff.
Yeah, I feel like there's little instances where, you know, there'd be a spooky episode of a show that's not spooky and you just love it. And, you know, you don't really conceptualize that as a budding horror fandom, but you just gravitate in that direction and it goes more and more. My entry to horror movies was books. I was a huge reader and I chewed through. I was a little bit too old for Goosebumps, but prior to Goosebumps, R.L. Stine had a series called Fear Street, and it was like a slasher teen YA series. I devoured that at a young age. And it wasn't long before that was a gateway to Stephen King. And then from Stephen King books, I wanted to see the adaptations of Stephen King books. And I started seeing Stephen King movies. And then the floodgates just busted open. And there was a like mom and pop video store a couple of blocks away from where I grew up. And, you know, they didn't give a crap how old you were. You could take out whatever you wanted. And that's when you kind of, you enter the age of just shopping by the lurid VHS box art. And that's kind of where I got my slasher education, all the garbage that I haven't seen or talked about since. It's all downhill from there.
I also really like, Andrea, your story about the cassette when you were little.
Oh, God. Yeah. You know those cassette tapes that that you would play at Halloween time, maybe outside? I think they were designed to be outside to like set the mood for your trick-or-treaters. My older sister caught me listening to one of those on a Walkman one time, and she said, that's when I knew you were weird.
Do you think horror is taken seriously in academia?
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't in sociology. I think it's worth mentioning that neither Alex nor I were educated in film, per se. Doing my master's thesis on zombie movies, I had to devote a chapter to justifying talking about movies at all. And I think if someone were in film, I presume they wouldn't have to do that. My second reader for defending my thesis was a film prof, and he was like, "You're preaching to the choir." And I was like, "Well, I have to." You know, at the time, there was literature available in the library that talked about horror films, but almost always from a film perspective and not from a cultural studies perspective. I have to assume that that's changed. I mean, I'm out of the game, but I think the fact that Alex and I are getting tapped to contribute chapters, even though we're outside of academia proper, says that something's going on in that department.
Yeah, the sense I get is that horror in academia is really fractured. It kind of depends if you've got like the right person in the right faculty at the right school, and they can kind of make some stuff happen. So it's kind of tricky. Like, I didn't really know anyone when I did my master's who was into horror. I just happened to mention it to a teacher I was working with, and he was like, "Huh." I was going to talk about, in my final paper, I was talking about horror films that purport to be real, because we're talking about simulacra and simulacrum, which, oh my God.
Baudrillard,
kill me now. And I remember talking to him about this, and I was like, yeah, well, I mean, there's the Blair Witch Project and stuff. And he was like, "Would you talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre?" And he was this like very like kind of like hippie, like theater guy, really nice, very chill. And I was like, "I could talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre." And he was like, "You should write on it. Like, I think this would be really great." And I was like, "Okay, random Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan. Let's do it." And so it's hard to say in academia proper. I mean, neither Andrea nor I have been in it, but I think that there is an appetite that Andrea and I are being asked to contribute these things, that I think people even outside of academia are putting together books and collections of essays about specific topics within horror, proves that there is an appetite. And I'm seeing more and more discourse online and in podcasts that takes these films and television shows and everything seriously, and, you know, really looks to break them down. So, I think there's probably still some healthy skepticism about horror, like, ooh, blood, gore. Ooh. But I think in order for academia to be relevant, you have to talk about popular culture. I mean, what else are you doing if you're not doing that?
You mentioned that when you started the podcast, there weren't a lot of other sort of horror podcasts going around, but since starting the podcast, have you found that there's a community in horror, or did you kind of have to like build it yourself?
I'm not going to take credit for building a community of horror podcasts. I would like to think that perhaps we might have inspired some of the podcasts that have come up in our wake, just given people the idea that, oh, like, anyone can do this. If these two assholes can pick up the microphone and talk into it and turn that into a show, then so can I. I think there was a time where networking with other podcasts was pretty important to me, because I wanted to learn, because I wanted our show to grow, because I wanted to share the knowledge. But I felt like that kind of tapered off as these groups and communities became too prescriptive. They became too all about best practices and white papers, and you know, you have to upload at the same time every week. And if you don't upload at least once a week, your show's not going to do well. And that kind of turned me off of that style of networking, because it's not what we do. It's not the way I roll.
Yeah. And I mean, I think like any kind of niche interest or general interest, there is always a community. So when Andrea and I kind of got into the horror scene here in Toronto, we were in our mid to late 20s, and now we're in our mid to late 30s. And certainly for me, when you know, we got to know each other, and as we were kind of entering this community, it was really, to me, dominated by a lot of straight white men who were about 10 years older than us. So a lot of our, certainly my opinion, seemed to be shit. The 90s were shit, everything was shit, and I probably didn't know a whole hell of a lot. There's certainly a lot of that I felt. And so for me, creating the podcast with Andrea was a way to kind of get like away from that, and just have conversations about stuff that we cared about, and that wasn't going to be shouted over by some dumb guy. And now what I've seen in the horror community, and I think with social media and you know, blogging, different websites, podcasts, YouTube channels, there's so many different communities within communities, and you can like find people. And it didn't feel like that when we started, and I'm really glad that, you know, I think someone can kind of enter the community now and start to find like-minded people, and maybe feel a bit less lonely or strange when they enter into it, because it's certainly a very weird feeling to kind of like seemingly find your tribe of like people who also love horror, and then to be told your opinions are wrong. Like, that's not good. Don't do that. That's shitty. Don't do that.
Yeah. And I think like little kind of pockets of horror podcasting have formed such that if you find our show and you like our show, you're naturally going to gravitate toward other shows that we mention on our show, shows that we consider our sister shows, shows that we've done guest spots on, and vice versa. So a community forms that way as well.
What do you think the future of filmmaking or film viewing will look like?
I think we're really, really spoiled for choice. I think as streaming is picking up steam, everybody has whatever they want kind of at their fingertips. And I think being spoiled for, like, there are good aspects of that and bad. I think, you know, we've all had the experience of scrolling through Netflix and acting like there's nothing to watch when there's tons of stuff to watch. I think more than ever, horror journalism has become relevant just to curate these selections, just to kind of guide you, to help you cut out the chaff. So I think the future of consuming horror is going to be finding these trusted sources of authority and taste. And fortunately, as Alex was just saying, there's a lot of that out there too. If you find an outlet or a personality that you like and you trust, you'll be able to kind of cut through all the chaff.
Yeah, I mean, streaming is so dominant right now. I mean, in the last year, we've had a complete industry upended by a pandemic and everyone staying at home. And there was already that pull towards that before the pandemic. And a lot of people were fighting for, you know, the importance of theatrical releases and making cases for it. And you can see that when there's a huge tentpole movie that has a cultural impact. And I hope that theaters are still in our future. I hope that they remain part of what we are allowed to do when it feels safe and we're all vaccinated and it feels good. My hope is that there's maybe a movement, not just on streaming, because I think we still see a bit of it on streaming, is some more kind of like mid-budget films. Not just, you know, because I feel like every time I would go to the theater, it'd be to like see the big blockbuster, like the big movie that was coming out this weekend and I wanted to make sure it wasn't spoiled for me, or the indie film that I wanted to go and support and like be immersed in the screen. And I'm hopeful that we'll get maybe some more kind of like, you know, $20 to $60 million budget films. But yeah, I think a lot of people are gonna feel like we've invested, you know, a lot of money maybe into our home setups and better audio, better screens, more streaming services. So I think it'll be kind of hard to break that. So I think the industry is going to have to challenge itself to remain relevant in a way that gets people out if and when it's safe to.
Do either of you have any advice for anyone watching who may be interested in a career in either horror journalism or podcasting?
Well, I have a full-time job that isn't horror, so I don't know how much of a career I can give advice on. I would say do it if you love it. Do it if you have an idea that isn't already being done. If there's something you really want to do and there's something similar out there, just make sure you know how yours is different. So yeah, make sure it's unique. Make sure you feel like, I feel this burning need inside of me to share something because it's not out there. It's not, I can't find it. And that was a lot of the impetus for Faculty of Horror. It was coming out of this kind of like bro heavy horror culture. And I was like, what if, you know, two women just got to talk for a little bit. And, I don't know. That's a tricky question because I don't have a career in horror. I have a passion for
horror. You wouldn't be getting gigs like this if you didn't have a career in horror.
Well, that's true. I mean, I did already steal Olivia's purple light, so who knows what else I could do.
And I think that like when we started Faculty of Horror, you're right. We wanted to be not a bro-y horror podcast, but I don't think we knew exactly what it was we were going to be. I think that just kind of it evolved after a while. We knew what we didn't want it to be. We knew what we wanted to offer, but there was a while where we didn't even embrace the term feminist. I think we're so conditioned to navigating this boys club that it's a four letter word.
Yeah. And I think it was really just, you know, we didn't, I mean, podcasts were so new back then. I was really getting into the medium and I really wanted to hear, you know, two women talk about horror, and I couldn't really reliably find that. Like they would sometimes pop up and then kind of disappear. And I was like, oh, and then the other thing was I just really started becoming quite close with Andrea and she was really busy all the time. So I was like, what if I trapped her in some kind of work partnership? And look where we are now on a Zoom call on a Thursday night.
I am busy all the time. And I think, you know, I think that's, I guess that's going to be my advice, is that if it doesn't exist, create it. That was true for the Faculty of Horror. That was true for the Black Museum, which I started up the same year, which was a lecture series here in Toronto, where we would invite instructors, experts in a given field to, you know, give a lecture on a given topic in horror. And that's still going on. I've since handed off the reins, but it's something that I envisioned with my co-founder, Paul Korup, and we decided to make it happen. And I think it was that entrepreneurial spirit that got people's attention, that this is someone who makes things happen. And I'm sure that's what earned me my seat at Remorgue, was the fact that through the podcast and through the Black Museum, I had demonstrated that I had something to say and that there were people out there willing to listen. Some people.
Yeah. And I also should add that I had, this is before I met Andrea, because this was right when I started doing freelance writing, I was doing a lot of fashion and beauty writing. And I was like, oh, I really enjoy it. I really, really like writing. And I think I tried to take this friend out for drinks, but I was very poor at the time and she wound up paying, which is very, very nice of her. She's a wonderful writer. Now she's a travel writer, Emma Yardley. And we sat down in a bar and I was like, I want to do this. What do I do? And she was like, well, do you love fashion and beauty? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, which do you love more? And I was like, mm-hmm. And she was like, okay, well, you have to know. You have to know, because so many people want to do these jobs. And if someone's going to come up behind you, you got to be prepared to like get scrappy about it. And he was very like, actually very friendly and very nice about it, but it was really honest. And I was like, well, then I don't know. And then I was like, well, you need movies. I love movies. And she was like, okay, what kind of movies? And I was like, horror movies. And she was like, quickest answer you gave me all night. I think you should write about horror movies. And so that kind of kicked it all off. But it was always this sense of like, you have to understand what you want and kind of go from it from there and like do your research and figure out what the publications are and what your what platforms you can have access to and be on, and then just be on them and kind of brand yourself and go do it. So that's kind of how some of that advice has helped me over the years, and just kind of what got me started, and I've evolved it and made it my own. But I think, yeah, know what you're willing to what you're really passionate about, and then go for it. And don't expect to get paid all the time. Have a, you know the Microsoft suite, know Excel, know Word, PowerPoint. Those are also good things for a day job.
Yeah, you both seem very, very busy, but other than faculty for, what do you have any other projects that you're working on right now?
No.
Honestly, I think juggling a full-time job and Faculty of Horror on the side was always a lot, especially when the podcast started growing and we needed to devote more attention, and you know, we wanted it to get better. So I started spending more and more time on research and honing my editing skills and whatnot. But now we have a Patreon, so we're making even more content. So I feel like I've got a 9-to-5 and a 5-to-9. Mm-hmm. I'm done. I'm tapped. That's it.
Yeah. I still do like writing stuff here and there whenever I can. Mainly whenever I kind of pull myself together and I feel like I really come up with an idea that I want to pitch and that I want to do, and I'll work with editors I know to kind of find a home for it, which I'm really fortunate to have those contacts and be able to do. But yeah, I think the longer Faculty of Horror goes on, the more I want to do it. And the more I realize, like, oh, it's not like I can ever just phone this in. I can't. Mm-hmm. I don't ever want to. You know, so I think there's always a bit of like good pressure. It's like every month it's like, oh, how are we going to bring it? How are we going to like, because there's always like, I feel really, I don't know, indebted probably isn't the right word, but I really care about our listeners and I really want to make sure they get something out of it. And then on top of that, it's always the when I like get Andrea with one of those like knowledge bombs and I'm like, my work is done. My work is done.
All worth it.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we move on to the audience questions?
Are there any?
Yeah, there are a few. And if anyone watching, if you have any questions, please put it in the Facebook Live chat and we'll try our best to get to them. So a question here from David. Are you excited for the incoming wave of COVID-inspired films? And have you seen any made thus far that you've liked?
I think Alex and I were both pretty blown away by Host, you know, just add our voices to the choir of praise over that. I think, you know, we're all kind of in a space, we're consuming so much material because we're stuck at home, but none of that material resonates with our lived reality right now, except that one spoke to it, and it felt really good. It felt really refreshing. It felt comforting, even though it was a scary movie with terrible things happening to these people in our boat.
Yeah. I also, yeah, as Andrew said, we both loved Host. I'm going to be very curious to see what the next 2 to 3 years gives us in terms of horror. Because I know people have been going back into production over the last, you know, 10 months or so, but there was a period where we all just kind of had to sit and think. And then there's also a period now where we are just in this, as Andrea said, a really bizarre lived reality and a really scary lived reality. So I think like the atmosphere is ripe for horror that speaks to right now. So I'm going to be really curious to see, you know, what kind of comes in the next few years and how these ideas are tackled. Maybe there'll be some that are really literal, like in Host, and some that are more metaphorical, but I'm down for whatever, because I need to interpret what the hell is going on right now.
I'll be interested to see if some of the big budget horror movies like are even going to kind of go there, or if they're just going to act like, ah, this is all going to blow over, everything's going to go back to normal, and we don't have to write in masks, and we don't have to write in social distancing. I feel like TV, you know, it's a little bit more immediate. We're going to start seeing that kind of stuff manifest in TV first.
Well, it's already on like a bunch of the new Real Housewives seasons, so.
There you go.
So the next question is from Thomas. Are there any VHS covers you saw as a kid in video rental stores that still haunt you? Something you saw on the shelf that you still haven't been able to bring yourself to watch?
Dr. Giggles stands out in my mind. I can picture it. I don't think there's any that I never saw as a result of being traumatized by the cover.
Yeah, I several of them are like flashing in my mind, but none that like scared me enough that I wouldn't see it. Yeah, but I always loved the Jack Frost one, the one that kind of had the reflex on it where he's like a happy snowman, now he's a killer snowman. That one is great.
I have a question here from Olivia, a different Olivia. Again, Cam reference.
Oh no, you've been replicated.
Yay. Well, y'all collab with Galos of Darkness again. That episode was so fun and I love both podcasts. Me too.
That was really fun. Like technologically, It wasn't that tricky. It wasn't that harrowing to do kind of a podcast crossover. I'd definitely be down to do that again. We did a crossover with Pseudopod for a couple of years. Do you remember, Alex?
Yep.
Pseudopod is a horror fiction podcast. And what we did was we would kind of, we would introduce the story and then we discussed it and Faculty of Horrorized it after the fact. That was fun.
Have another question from Laura. What horror movie monster or villain would you love to party with on the assumption that they're all chill and not trying to murder anyone at the time? And I guess when parties aren't illegal.
Right.
Pinhead, for sure. I would party with the Cenobites just for the fashion.
Shoot, that's a good question. I'm now like frantically like looking... No, well, you know what, I'm going to call them monsters because screw it, it's our talk. I want to party with the like Tons Dance Theater from Suspiria. I want to party with those witches. I'm going to wear a bunch of string outfits. Do that.
I want to take you to the prom with Carrie. I want to call the corners with the craft.
Yes.
I have another question from Keith. Speaking of the boys club, do you find there's a tension between the horror form, which tends to be subversive and political and prone to feminist reading, with an audience that could tend to be conservative and unwilling to examine the darker topics that are normally explored in horror films?
Yes, and I feel like we've been hearing more from them recently. Mm-hmm. And it's not always like super aggressive. It's not, you know, it's like no one needs to feel bad for us. We're big girls. I've noticed an uptake of people either in our iTunes reviews or emails or tweets or DMs or whatever it is, being very concerned with our liberal politics. And this is really, I've noticed this really since Biden won, after he stole the election, of course. And it was like all of this stuff kind of like blew open with this kind of conservative culture war. And so people have been very, it feels like not, again, it's probably just like tens of people, but it's tens of more people than we've ever normally gotten, being very concerned about how left-leaning our politics are and why can't we just enjoy something and why can't we? And it's like, because the world's not going to be habitable after like 2069. I don't know if you guys know this or not. Mm-hmm. Like, scientists have said this. Yeah. So yeah, it's a tension there, and yeah, it's it's hard because I try to engage with it a little bit when I can and when I have the bandwidth and the energy. But again, it's like, you've got a full-time job, you have a life, you have this, and you could catch me on a horrible day. And it's like, I don't want to fucking explain my politics to you. Mm-hmm. But often I try to. And I always just get this response where I'm like, but you're not going to hear me. Like, you're not really listening to what I have to say. I have trouble listening to them because I'm like, the world is dying.
These are very, very, very polarizing times. And I think I encounter it mostly with the magazine. Being editor of Rumorg, I think when I took the helm, I was definitely steering it in a bit of a different direction than the previous editor. And, you know, I expected some readers to drop off and some readers to not like where I was taking it. And so I was prepared for that. What I maybe wasn't prepared for was the backlash over this past year. And the tricky thing with making a magazine, a periodical that comes out several times a year, is you have to keep it relevant and you have to keep it fresh. And during times of great political upheaval, it would be ridiculous to try and make something relevant without addressing the violence and the turmoil and the pain that is happening in our streets. Like, I feel like that would be, you know, not just irresponsible, but just dumb. But I've heard from a lot of readers who are just, keep your politics to yourself. And I truly don't know how to do my job without, calling out injustice when I see it, because horror movies reflect those injustices and I can't just switch that off.
Yeah. And it's not like our politics have ever been, you know, really new to the podcast. You know, our first year, we kind of realized that this was the direction we were going to go in, just because this is where our analysis led us. And we certainly called out politics in a lot of, horror films that we cover from all over the world. And no one ever seemed to have a lot of problems when we were calling out like the far right in France. But then all of a sudden you get to like America and people are like, excuse me, how dare you? And it's like,
I also feel like even the term political has gotten into this like slippery, weird thing. Like, I got in so much trouble for calling Martin Scorsese a white male. And it's like, you know, take your woke feminist politics. It's like, what? These are adjectives. Can I speak English? Is that okay? To take a stand on Black Lives Matter is political when it shouldn't be, like humanitarian human rights stuff. Like, I feel like I don't even know what is and isn't political anymore. So to try and avoid those pitfalls is futile.
Okay, another question from Michael. How important do you feel horror is as a cathartic device to deal with trauma?
Ooh, I think, again, that's going to be a very individual, specific to you, specific to your trauma, specific to your situation. I think there's always a really fine line, what's cathartic and what's triggering. Mm-hmm. And we're very sensitive to that, and we try to give appropriate trigger warnings in our episodes. And, I'm not sure how to answer that.
I will say, because I agree with everything Andrea said, it's incredibly individual. Trauma is individual, processing trauma is individual, and finding a healthy way to live beyond it is really, really personal. I will say that there is incredible power in representation. When you see something you recognize from your own life represented on screen and it feels to some degree accurate, to some degree truthful, it can be incredibly powerful and it can be very reassuring. I've seen some people write really personal essays and blog posts about, you know, I saw this rape revenge film and it meant something to me because I saw that trauma on screen and it made my trauma feel less isolated, less alone, because I saw it out there and it could kind of relate to me in some way. I think it's incredibly powerful, and horror can really have that power because, like we were talking about earlier, horror deals with all those things we try to hide and that society tries to sanitize. So I think for people who are ready and able to maybe confront in a bit more of an aggressive way some trauma, then yeah, I can definitely see it being helpful. But yeah, it's such to, yeah, literally just paraphrase what Andrea said, the fine line between trigger warning and something that's healing is so thin, and it's so tricky to navigate. So you have to be really careful with yourself if you're heading down that road.
So I have one last question from Katie. Do you feel that there has been a shift in female-driven characters shown in horror as a genre? And what is an example of the changes you've been drawn to?
I think one of the reasons why I've really fallen in love with horror is because female characters are so prominent, you know, from the final girl to, you know, a multitude of other characters. Women are usually at the center of a horror film. It feels much rarer for a male story to be central to the story. I would say I've noticed some really cool stuff in the last few years. It's not that it's the first time that ever happened, but particularly with Robert Eggers, The Witch, that ending being so subversive and so powerful was like a, because the tricky thing with horror was always like, you know, the final girl is like fighting and does all this, and then by the end she has to collapse into Dr. Loomis's arms and be like, you know, there was always this reaffirming of a cultural norm that the characters had usually been fighting against to some degree. And I think with The Witch, we saw like, what if we just broke it? And what if we just did something different? And that was really exciting. And I feel like I'm seeing more and more films like that now, which is amazing.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, you know, the final girl has been so cemented into the horror genre. I think there was a while where everybody was really desperate to subvert that and be like, okay, well, my final girl is a bad girl, or my final girl does this and that differently. And one really exciting thing that I'm seeing is just more female filmmakers out there, because I can feel it when it's a female character that's, and there's a woman behind the camera. I can feel it, I can sense it. There's a lot more authentic female characters coming out, complicated female characters who don't just kind of fall under that virgin whore binary that I'm just so sick of. So that's one trend I'm really excited about.
So that's kind of it for our lecture today. Thank you so much for speaking with us and for all your very thoughtful answers. Where can people find your work and listen to your podcast?
You can find Faculty of Horror wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that's Apple app, another app, Spotify, wherever podcasts are found. I think we're there. You can also find more about us as well as all of our episodes at facultyofhorror.com. We also have a reading list there with a lot of the books we tend to cite and use a lot. So if you're looking to get more into horror academia, you can check us out there. We're on Facebook, on the Twitter. We both have personal Instagram pages and personal Twitter pages and things like that. Andrea, what did I miss?
And if you like the show, be sure to subscribe to our Patreon.
Yeah.
How did you miss that? You're fired.
Thank God I have that day job to fall back on.
There's a lot of bonus content on there. I'm pretty proud of it. You can find us individually on social media. You can find us together. And if you're interested in my writing, what's this I have here? Oh, I'm the editor of Room Morgue. I write a lot of stuff in here all the time. This is the March-April issue that just came out. It's available for pre-order now. Support independent print.
Cool. Yeah, and thank you.
Great questions. Thank you.
So thanks again, and thanks to the Uniter for hosting.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys. Good night.
Of our annual budget comes from listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting CKUW 95.9 FM at Fundrive.